going through the Song of Ascents. If you don't know what that is, it's a group of psalms in the book of Psalms. It's 15 of them. They describe this journey of moving far from the presence of God to moving right into his intimate presence. And as we have been journeying through this, we've been reading these psalms, which, if you don't know what psalms are, they're poetic songs. They are not just songs, but also prayers. They teach us what it means to actually pour out our heart before God. And if you're here today, I can guarantee you, whether you believe in Jesus or not, you are on a journey of some kind, and you're hoping to find peace within this life. And what we believe here is we believe that Jesus will show us the way. He is the one, he is the purpose for what we journey for in life, and he's also the only one who can actually give us peace. Nothing else, no one else can. So that's to give you a little intro into where we've been. We're about halfway through, and what I love about this group of psalms is that it's not cut and dry. It's not like this journey that's nice and seamless where you start at the bottom and you're just like, all right, it's just upwards from here. No, it's more like a mountain range where there's moments of peaks. In fact, we were just at Psalm 128, and it's the psalm of blessing, the main idea being that we carry the blessing that Jesus gives us through the gospel, and it's a nice psalm. It makes you feel good, but then all of a sudden, it's like you walked off a cliff into Psalm 129, and all of a sudden, it seems like, whoa, this is a psalm of lament, of crying out because of oppression and because of whatever suffering you may be going through. To help understand a little bit of this psalm, if you look at Psalm 129, verse 3, it says, the plowers plowed upon my back. They made long their furrows. I read this with my family about a month ago, and this is just a very deep and deep metaphor that's being described here. And if you've ever seen or watched through a movie or something of someone being whipped and what that looks like, this is what it's describing. In fact, there is a story from the Civil War of a slave who was mercilessly beat by his slave masters. And after one terrible beating, he resolved to escape. At this time, the Civil War was going on, so his hope was to cross from the Confederate states to the Union side in order to find freedom. During his escape, he had to do things like rub onions on his clothes and skin to escape the search dogs that were hunting him down. He eventually made his way to the Union Army camp. And it was there, as the surgeons were taking care of him and they removed the clothes off of him, that they found this scarring that was on his back, and he got the name of Whipped Peter. And his photograph was actually used and spread across the North at that time as a way to encourage abolitionists who were in the fight to help see black Americans be set free. This is a terrible tragedy that we see. This is what oppression looks like. When you read this verse in Psalm 129:3, the plowers plowed upon my back, they made long their furrows. This is the imagery. This is the reality of someone who's suffering from oppression, whether that's physically, spiritually, emotionally, and what that looks like. And we see that all the time across many different peoples, no matter what your skin color is, what your culture is. You go through whatever it is, everyone has been oppressed, and everyone has also been the oppressor when it comes to where we are spiritually. Let me give you a different example of what this looks like. Because most of us have not experienced what Peter went through. And my wife and I, we lost our first spouses to death. And it's something, when we've told our stories to people, it can be very jarring. It's like, well, I've never experienced that. Well, there was one time where I was having someone talk to me, a young man, and he was, you know, infatuated with this girl, and things didn't turn out the way it was supposed to be, and he's talking with me and being like, dude, this is like hurting me, I'm devastated, and I'm just sitting there listening to this, and my first reaction is like, you don't know what pain is. You don't know what it's like to go through the suffering that I've gone through. And that's when God spoke to me. And he said, yeah, he doesn't know what you've gone through, but I still care about his pain. Like, I still care about his pain. Like, for that kid at that time, that's what he knew, is pain and grief. He's going through the sufferings of this world. He has gone through something that wasn't great. And so you may be here today, and maybe you have a terrible tragedy that you are wearing that is on your heart right now, whatever that may be. Or maybe you're here today and you're like this young man, where maybe it's not that big of a deal. Maybe it's not as big of a suffering as maybe someone else. But we still can bring that to Jesus. This psalm is for all who have suffered. It is for all who are oppressed. And I encourage that you come here, and maybe you're not even in that place of suffering right now. Then use this psalm and hold it tight for when that moment does come, as we live in this sin-sick world, that you hold that tight to your chest. And here's the main idea behind where we're going today. The Lord is righteous. And because the Lord is righteous, we can share our deepest griefs. And we can be confident, because he's righteous, that he will act against the wicked. Would you pray with me? God in heaven, we need you today. We need your word. We need your truth. Jesus, we need you to walk through this life. Like we prayed earlier, we're fragile. Jesus, we get hit by all sorts of things, and things that disrupt us, things that grab us away from your peace. But God, you're with us in the middle of storms. You're with us when there's green grass. You're with us at all points. And so Jesus, even in this darker psalm, I just pray that we'd remember that even in the dark valleys, even in the deepest depths, you are with us. And so I pray, Jesus, help us hold this psalm close. In your name we pray, amen. So first of all, we're gonna talk about the Lord is righteous. Now, if you're like me, you grew up in the church, you probably heard that term or this idea of righteousness attached to the Lord. And similarly to a couple sermons ago, we talked about this idea of like God being, whether it's a judge or righteousness or fearing the Lord was what we looked at last week. Sometimes we hear those things and we think of God as like this looming God who isn't near to us, who doesn't care about us. And sometimes we can think about that with righteousness. We think, okay, since God is righteous, that means he's separated from me and he doesn't care about me because I'm not righteous. And there's a little bit of truth to that, right? There's this idea that, yes, God is holy and he's righteous, but that doesn't equate to him staying his distance. In fact, when you look at what Jesus Christ did on the cross, he did the very opposite and came near to us. So I want to talk about this for a minute because it sets up where we're going with this psalm. A great theologian, Wayne Grudem, said this: in English, the terms righteousness and justice are different words, but in both the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament, there is only one word group behind these two English terms. So what that means is righteousness and justice, they're like two sides of the same coin. So let me help you understand this a little bit. First of all, righteousness, it's like a character description. It means that you are right, that you are just. And it's a characteristic that only God could upkeep, or a sinless humanity. But that's the problem, right? We read in Romans 3, 10 through 12, it says, "No, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside together. They have become worthless. No one does good, not even one." Righteousness refers to God being the standard of what is good and right. So if you're a kid here and you're under, you know, whether you're in high school, lower than that, or you're 5 or 6, this is a concept you can understand because your parents set the standard for what is right. If you're stepping out of line, your parents are going to let you know. Your parents hold the standard that is right. So how do you know what's right? Well, your parents will tell you. So how do we know what's right? We look to God because he is righteous. He is the standard for righteousness. And how do we know this? Well, it comes through his word. This becomes our means then of coming to understand who God is, his character. We understand what he does and the good things that he does. That's why reading is so essential. This is righteousness. Then justice. Justice is the act of keeping things right. So you think about righteousness as a characteristic. Justice is the action that's behind righteousness. So Wayne Grudem again, he says, God's righteousness means that God always acts in accordance with what is right and is himself the final standard of what is right. And this is why we're so frustrated with the world and the way it is. I mean, look at the last few years, politically, socially, all the tensions that have come up is because people are wanting to see things done rightly. And when things aren't done right, it grates against us. There's a part of our soul, there's some part of us that wants to see things lined up, wants to see consistency, and we can't accomplish it on our own. I mean, this is the reality, isn't it? Is that if you put your hope in politicians, if you put your hope even in yourself, your tribe, your people group, whatever social group you may be part of, eventually things fall apart because none of us are righteous. None of us are able to keep that standard. But the Lord is righteous. And so when you look at this psalm, right in the middle, what does it say in verse 4? It says, the Lord is righteous. This is the key to everything that's said within this psalm. This is the key for every person who has suffered under some injustice. This is the key for anyone who has felt the pain of a sin-sick world in which things aren't measuring up to what is right. The last term that plays into this as we talk about the idea that the Lord is righteous is the question of who are the wicked that are mentioned in this. What are the wicked? Who are the wicked? When you look at the Hebrew word that's used for it, it's morally wrong, concretely, an actively bad person, condemned, guilty, ungodly, wicked man that did wrong. So this is a dictionary definition. But think of it in this way. It's very much opposite of what righteousness and justice is. It's someone who's actively opposed to the right standard that God gives. Someone who's actively opposed, walking, thinking, acting in such a way that's against God and what he is doing. And this is the hard part, isn't it? Because, wait, if we're all not righteous, like Romans said, then that then means we are all wicked if we're apart from Christ. And this is why the cross matters so much. Because God can take us on that journey, on that path where he flips us from a place of being wicked and opposed to him, from being in a place of oppression, while also being the oppressor because of what sin does in our life. He takes that and he can make us good. He can bring us to that standard of righteousness. So let me read this. It's Romans 3:25 through 26. I put it in the New Living Translation because I think it sums it up in a way that's a little bit better to understand. It says this, for God presented Jesus as a sacrifice for sin. People are made right with God when they believe that Jesus sacrificed his life, shedding his blood. The sacrifice shows that God was being fair when he held back and did not punish those who sinned in times past, for he was looking ahead and including them in what he would do in this present time. God did this to demonstrate his righteousness, for he himself is fair and just, and he declares sinners to be right in his sight when they believe in Jesus. God is always right, and he has the power to maintain what is right. So why do we need to talk about God's righteousness? Why start this way before we get to the psalm? I love the way one of my professors at seminary, Tony Morita, he put it this way for this psalm. In seasons of trials, ponder the Lord's attributes. Ponder his work in history. Ponder his promises. He is righteous. He is a rescuer. Let hope arise as you ponder his ways. You will need good theology in dark moments. You see, theology isn't just this dry topic. It literally means knowledge of God, coming to know God. And when you know God, when you put that effort in, that theology isn't just some dry knowledge that resides in your gray matter brain cells. It is something for your soul that will help you walk through the dark times of life, to trust and believe in the promises that he's given us. So with that, let's look at the fact that because the Lord is righteous, we can share our deepest griefs. The first three verses of Psalm 129. Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth. Let Israel now say, greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. The plowers plowed my back. They made long their furrows. We see this, a couple of things going on in this passage. And a couple psalms ago, we saw this same kind of moment where there's this individual saying, greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, but then he invites the entire people. Let Israel now say, greatly have they afflicted me from my youth. And most likely that term, my youth, is referring to Israel all the way back from when, most likely, thinking about the time they were slaves in Egypt, thinking about the times when they were feeling the whip, the times when they had oppressors who were saying, you need to throw your male children into the river. They're thinking back to that time in their history, and then they keep walking that up back to where they are. They've seen the oppression that has happened within their life, and they're acknowledging it. They're speaking it out loud. They're saying, yes, I have suffered from this. But then they say, we have suffered with this together. And this is so critical, especially in a culture that we're in, that especially in Alaska, let's be real, where we tend to be more individualist, where we think we can kind of grab our pain, hold it inside, and just move through life, and that somehow that's going to work out well. I don't care who you are, it just doesn't work well. And what's so beautiful about this first part is it says, look, acknowledge that deep pain. Acknowledge it to the Lord. Acknowledge it to the Lord together. And acknowledge where the pain is coming from. I mean, look at it. There's this word in there, they have not prevailed against me in verse 2, and they afflicted me in verse 1 and verse 2. Who is the they in there? See, what's great about these psalms is I believe God put these in here to be intentionally general. Because, like we said before, all of us have suffered in some way and in different various means. And so this allows us to come and bring this before God. So who's the they? For Israel, that could be Egypt. That could be Babylon when they were exiled. It could be whatever power was coming in and taking them out of their land. It could be, for some of us, it could be ourselves. We often sometimes can be our own oppressor, right? Whether that's through addictions, whether that's through poor judgments that we make, and there's that cry that we hear so often of like, save me from myself. Or maybe circumstances that are out of our control. We live in this world and we don't know what's going to happen. And sometimes calamity visits. And the circumstances that are out of our control because we live in a sin-sick world that generally runs opposed to God. So I want to give you an illustration that is so beautiful about what God does in our deep pain. I got this from Robert Kellerman, wrote a fantastic book on counseling. He used this imagery of climbing in the casket. So the casket is whatever you're in, the death you're experiencing in this life, whatever tragedy that's brought you to a dark valley. And that oftentimes when we're walking with people as a community, the first thing you have to do is step into the casket. Where you, it's this vivid metaphor of like literally just getting in and being like, I'm going to sit with you in your death and your pain and hear what you're walking through. And I'm not even going to say anything necessarily. And isn't this what Jesus did for us? Think about it. Righteous God. And he comes to earth as a human. He didn't stay separate. In fact, he walks in to our very situation. He experiences life as it is. And then when you take this metaphor all the way to its end, he goes to the cross. He brings all the oppression, all the evil, all the wickedness, he brings upon himself on that cross. Everything that God hates as a just and righteous God, he experiences that and he goes into the casket. He goes into the grave. He's put there, and this is where it's so beautiful, is Jesus doesn't stay dead, does he? He doesn't stay in the casket. He rises up, and he walked out of that 3 days later. Bodily resurrection comes out, and so this is why we give Jesus our deep pain. That's why when we are walking with people in pain as a community together, our goal is to point them to Jesus, but not in a casual way, not in a way that's just like, yeah, you should maybe pray to God more or something like that. Often it can be easy because we don't know what else to say. But the end goal is that Jesus is the only one who can bear our deepest griefs. He's the only one who can walk with us. And so what can happen too through this is not only acknowledging deep pain, but we see also persevering through affliction. It's that line in verse 2 where it says, yet they have not prevailed against me. There's still life. They still keep going. You see, we see this analogy of furrows and ditches in their back, the suffering they're going through. It speaks of all this pain. It speaks of someone else beating you down, but not giving up. There's a beautiful book in the Bible, 2 Corinthians. It's a letter, and it starts out like dark. Like Paul's writing to this church, and he's sharing like, man, we felt like death. He and the people who were in ministry with him, they were not in a good spot. But he writes this in 2 Corinthians 4:7-12. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show you that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. We believe that God is bringing all things to a right end and that we are part of this process. And what I love about this passage and what it means is like, yeah, you might be suffering through something that's like death. In fact, if you look at the character of Job, who we've been using in the last couple of sermons, we see that he suffered the loss of everything and even has his own wife saying, curse God and die. And yet, he comes to this point where he encounters the one true God and is literally floored, like coming to this place of like, this is what life is about. It's this relationship with God. And why do you think that happened to Job? Why do you think that happened to Job? So we could read this later in our pain, in our grief, and see a man who suffered the loss of so much and be like, maybe I can persevere. Maybe I can keep going because maybe God will use what I'm going through and use it in the life of another person to help them keep going. The Lord is righteous when it comes to our pain, and he faced the greatest pain so we could give him ours. I'll end this point with a couple quotes from Isaiah. Isaiah 53:7-9 says this, speaking of the future Messiah, Jesus. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people, and they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. You see, there's this question that people often ask. Why do bad things happen to good people? And I can't remember who this came from, but it's a great answer. There was only ever one good person that bad things happened to, and that was Jesus. The rest of us, yeah, we've been that bad person. We have deserved a lot of the stuff that we've gotten. And because of our sin-sick world, we deserve all the repercussions. But then what does Jesus do? He comes in our place. He's oppressed. He's the one who doesn't deserve the death, but he goes through it. And then if you read in Isaiah 53:4, and back up a little bit, it says, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. God understands your pain. He understands your betrayals. He understands whatever pain you are carrying today, and he can carry it. So, because God is that standard of righteousness, because he knows exactly what is right and what is not, he knows even more than you do the tragedies that you're going through and the oppression that you might be suffering from. So the last point we're looking at is because the Lord is righteous, we can trust that he will act against the wicked. This is the last verses 4-8. The Lord is righteous. He has cut the cords of the wicked. May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward. Let them be like the grass on the housetops, which withers before it grows up, with which the reaper does not fill his hand, nor the binder of sheaves his arms. Nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. This is sobering in many different ways. It's a description of what will happen to the wicked ultimately. It's what happens to those who are acting against God's right standard. And there are so many examples when it comes to it. The most vivid one we just saw at the beginning of this sermon, of someone who was whipped as a slave and suffering that kind of oppression. But think about it. This happens with siblings all the time, doesn't it? Usually, it's the older sibling who's oppressing the younger, but it goes vice versa. I was a younger sibling, right? Usually, the younger sibling oppresses by doing the sneaky things, like they do the poking first, and then the older one just wails on them next. And think about how that creates the environment of the home. Kids especially. It isn't good for you. It isn't good for your parents. This is us trying to act in our own power, and that happens in our own wickedness. And guess what? As a parent, we can sometimes oppress our children, don't we? Acting in a way that, if we're honest, we're like, I just want to make it easier for me than actually care about what my kids deserve. That happens sometimes. It's any way, and we can see multiple examples across this in our society, right, where the power act against the powerless. And that's why earlier I said we are all oppressed at some point, and we are the oppressors at some point because of the way sin operates in our world. And this portion of the psalm is a reminder of the path of the wicked and where it ends. It's a consolation that wickedness has a time limit. Oppression will not last forever. There will be an end. So I'm just going to walk through this real quickly about the descriptions that happen. First of all, as we look at verse 4, the wicked are not in control. God will cut off their power. We actually see this mimicked in a previous psalm, in Psalm 125, verse 3. It says, "For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land allotted to the righteous, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong." No matter what happens to you, no matter what we go through together as a family here at this church, the control of the wicked is temporary. It will come to an end. We also see that the wicked are headed in the wrong direction. God will not allow the wicked into his presence. And it uses that term, may all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward. Well, what does that mean, all who hate Zion? Zion represents a lot. It can represent Jerusalem, where God's presence was. It represents Israel, whom God's presence was upon because they were God's people. It is centered around this idea of God's presence and what that matters, meaning those who are opposed, those who are wicked, who are against God, his standard, what's going to happen? They're going to be put to shame and turned backward. So no matter what happens, if you're headed against God, it's going to end in disaster. Sure, you can experience good things in this earth now. You can see people who are acting wickedly thrive in this earthly time. But at some point, they're going to be forgotten if they keep going that direction. In fact, what we see here is an anti-song of ascents. We've been describing this journey of moving towards the presence of God, of finding the peace that only God can offer. Well, if you're opposed to his standard of righteousness, you're going to end up in the wrong direction. We also see this in Psalm 125, verse 5 as well. It says, "But those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead away with the evildoers." We also see that the wicked will be unfruitful, unproductive, that they will wither. So this contrasts the psalm we looked at in Psalm 128. If you just look back one psalm, the first two verses, it says this, Psalm 128, 1 through 2. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. You shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands. You shall be blessed, and it will be well with you. God promises the blessing of fruitfulness and meaningful labors to those who fear him and walk in his ways. And it all centers around a relationship with him. But if that relationship isn't the center and you're walking opposed to him, everything you do in this life, it's meaningless. It doesn't matter in the end. We also see that the wicked will not be blessed by God's community. Consider Psalm 1, verse 5. It says, therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, meaning they don't have any ability to physically stand up. They won't be able to stand proudly. They are going to be put down. Nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. This is very much opposed to what we see at the end of Psalm 128, 5 through 6. We see this community blessing that happens, a benediction, where it says, the Lord bless you from Zion. And then later on it says, may you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. For those who are opposed to God, they aren't walking in blessing. They aren't carrying blessing. In fact, they still carry that burden and shame that sin gives us. So this is the description of what's going to happen to the wicked. And it's written in this psalm, in this song format, so people remember, like, okay, there is wickedness, there's unrighteousness, there's injustice happening all around me. But the Lord is coming back. The Lord will prevail amongst all of that. So what can we take from this? First of all, the Lord will act against the wicked so we can bring our injustice before Jesus. We understand that the only person who will ultimately make things right will be Jesus when he returns. He will come to bring his final judgment. He will come to bring final justice. He will come to make all things right and instate righteousness. And this is one of the problems we're facing right now, is that it's so easy to either in our own power or hope in the power of another human being that they're going to eventually bring an answer to the injustices that are happening. But we have to remember, as God's family, as God's people, that we operate as strangers and sojourners here in this earth. And he's the only one who will ultimately bring justice to this world. Now, does that mean we don't act against injustice? No, it doesn't mean that. But it also means that you don't put someone else in that savior role, because they are ultimately going to disappoint you and it's not going to bring a final fulfillment. The other reasons we bring our injustice to a righteous God and the injustices that come against us to a righteous God is because what did Jesus do when he was faced with injustice? How did he face the ultimate injustices that he faced as the only true and righteous human being? He met our injustices with his death and resurrection on the cross. He met our unrighteousness with forgiveness. When we rightly bring our injustices and pains to Jesus, he will lead us to show mercy, grace, and forgiveness to those who don't deserve it. Luke 23:32 through 34 brings us right to that moment on the cross. It says, two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they cast lots to divide his garments. The contrast of that last verse is so powerful. Jesus saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And the immediate words after, and they cast lots to divide his very garments. This is Jesus' reaction. And so in bringing our injustice to Jesus, we must do so humbly. He takes our right anger and frustration, and it should lead us to the cross where we see Jesus created a pathway for the wicked to become righteous. So I want to encourage you, in whatever you're facing, whatever sufferings you're coming against, that this psalm teaches us, first of all, what we are supposed to do. Our first spot for the injustices that we face is to do what Israel did. Cry out to God. not only individually, but share it with your family and bring it. And we come to Jesus and say, come, Lord Jesus, come, because you're the only one who's going to bring true justice. And then from there, we let Jesus lead us in the actions that we need to take here on this earth. The Lord acts against the wicked, so we keep following him. This comes off of what we read in a couple of verses earlier. Yet they have not prevailed against me. We don't give up hope. We remember that there is life that we can experience in Jesus now. We get to experience it here. It's a benefit. It's a beauty. But we also know that there is a fuller life to come in what Jesus came to do. So your story of following Jesus, just like with Job, will help others fix their eyes on Jesus when they face difficult mountains in the dark valleys of their journey. Maybe you're at a place where you have those moments alone where it just feels like, I've got nothing of worth. Maybe you're feeling I'm worthless. Maybe you're feeling like the pain you're going through is pointless, and it's just leading you to a place of, I don't know, just the reality and the place we live here in Alaska is for many people that can even lead to suicide. And we miss the beauty of our story and what God's doing in us. That we're part of his story that began all the way back at Genesis. That our stories, when they're in Jesus, have a purpose and a beauty, and it's seen in community when we share our stories, encourage each other on. So I just want to say, there may be someone this week who needs to hear your story. No matter what your story is like, what your background is, what culture you're coming from, whatever it may be, I need to hear your stories. You need to hear each other's stories. And we carry blessings to one another when we share about how God helps us, how he helps us persevere. We encourage people sometimes, even when we're like, hey guys, guess what? I mean, I was talking to a pastor friend of mine. I was talking to Caleb Richardson. Some of you know him. He's a pastor down in the Matsu Valley. And he was just being real with me. He's been saying, hey, this is where I'm at right now, and it's discouraging. And I don't have anything to say. Like, he's my mentor, and he's bringing this. And sometimes you kind of think of people like that, oh, yeah, they got it all together. And he's like, no, he's human too, and he's coming and he's saying, hey, this is where I'm discouraged. And it offered the opportunity for me to be able to walk with him, to be able to pray with him, pray over him, I should say. I didn't on the phone, but be praying over him just a couple hours ago. And so in sharing it, I also know, like, hey, I may be in that time. There may be a time, it could be tomorrow, where I'm the one who's like, man, I don't know what to do with life right now. It's a struggle. It's hard. And I need to be willing to share it with my family so that just like at the beginning of the psalm, we not only cry out ourselves to the Lord, but we cry out together as a family. So I want to end on this note. Remember this, God put you here for a purpose of spreading his good news. Like Job, who lost everything, your story, like his, is one, honestly, of perseverance. Our pains can turn into blessings for others. Like Israel's stories of trials, suffering, sins, mistakes, still points to Jesus, still points to his redemption. It's amazing that when you suffer pain, you can understand how to love others better who also face pain, so you can genuinely point them to Jesus. And I'll end on this quote. It's from The Two Towers. It says this, it's like in the great stories, the ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end, because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. And when the sun shines, it will shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you, that meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. But I think I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't. They kept going because they were holding on to something. That there is some good in this world, and it's worth fighting for. The good in this world is Jesus Christ and the gospel you carry, and it's worth fighting for.